This is 20 VC with me, Harry Stebbings, and I do have to laugh because it took 5 years until we had our first guest on the show from LATAM, and then we have Simon on the show from Rappi last week, and today I'm so thrilled to welcome David Velez, founder and CEO at Nubank. For those that do not know, Nubank is one of the fastest growing digital banks in the world, with operations in Brazil, Mexico, Argentina, and Colombia. To fuel this incredible growth, David has raised over $1.5 billion for Nubank from some of the best in the business, including Doug Leone at Sequoia, Mickey at Ribbit, Thrive, Founders Fund, DST, Tiger, and more. Before changing the world of LATAM finance, David was a partner at Sequoia, where he was responsible for all LATAM investments. And prior to Sequoia, David was the co-founder of General Atlantic's South American Investment Program. I'd also then want to say a huge thank you. This schedule was made so much better by Doug Leone at Sequoia and Jeff Lewis at Bedrock, who provided some amazing question suggestions today, so I really do appreciate that. But before we dive into the show today, did you know that more than 80% of US public stock is owned by just 10% of Americans. This divide is even greater in the private markets. Carta makes it as easy to issue equity to your employees as it is to issue payroll, and for employees, as easy to accept it too. More than 16,000 companies issue equity to their employees through Carta. Whether you're just getting started or getting ready to go public, the team at Carta can help. Check them out at carta.com. And then another incredible product you have to introduce is SecureFrame. SecureFrame helps companies get enterprise ready by streamlining SOC 2 and ISO 27001 compliance. SecureFrame allows companies to get compliant within weeks rather than the painful months that is today. Join companies like Stream, Hasura, Benepass, and unlock more sales with SecureFrame. And 20VC listeners get 10% off at SecureFrame.com/20VC. And finally, I've always been a big history fan, and so I want to talk about Cooley, the global law firm built around startups and venture capital. Since forming the very first venture fund in Silicon Valley, Cooley's formed more venture capital funds than any other law firm in the world, with 50 plus years working with VCs. They help VCs form and manage funds, make investments, and handle the myriad of issues that arise throughout a fund's lifetime. So to learn more about the number one most active law firm representing VC-backed companies going public, head over to Cooley.com and also check out CooleyGo.com. But that's enough from me, so now I'm so excited to hand over to David Velez, founder and CEO at Nubank.
3, 2, 1, 0. You have now arrived at your destination.
David, it is such a joy to have you on the show today. As I said, I've heard so many great things from Doug Leone, from Woody at TCV, from Jeff. So thank you so much for joining me today.
Now, thank you, Harry, for the invitation. It's a pleasure to be here with you. And also, I'm glad you're looking at Latin America. I'm inviting a couple of guests here as well. So very excited to be on your podcast.
Well, listen, the pleasure is all mine. I've been a big follower of Nubank for a while now. So I want to start with a little bit on the story, because Nubank's this kind of behemoth in market today. And I want to ask, like, how did you make your way from, you know, partner at Sequoia to founding Nubank? And what was that aha moment for you?
Well, the reality is I always wanted to be an entrepreneur. I'm from originally from Colombia. I come from a family of entrepreneurs on both sides, both my mom and my dad and my grandpas on both sides. They're all entrepreneurs, small businesses, but the entrepreneurial Kool-Aid was served daily at home. And so I grew up always thinking that at some point I wanted to go on my own, that I wanted to start my own path. It took me almost 13 years of experience to finally get to the point where I was ready to pull the trigger. I had to do, you know, I ended up doing financial services in New York for a number of years. That took me to private equity and growth equity in Brazil. That was how I ended up in Brazil in 2008 for the first time. And then went back to business school. And the first week of business school, I was ready to enjoy 2 years of semi-vacation, spending time thinking about the idea of the start that I wanted to start. And I got a call from Doug Leone saying, I heard about you, come meet me at Sequoia. And so I was like, okay, I'll go meet him at Sequoia. And we had an amazing conversation of 45 minutes. They were starting to think about doing something in Brazil. 2 minutes after I left that first meeting, I had an email from Michael Moritz in my inbox saying, please come back, let's talk. And then very quickly, over a week, I talked to all the GPs at Sequoia and found myself with a job again. And it was right at the beginning of my supposedly business school vacation. So it was a great experience. I ended up doing that for 2 years, both working at Sequoia, helping them think through opportunities that in Latin America in tech investing, which is what I had done before for General Atlantic. But always thinking about it on the other side of the brain, what is this, the company that I want to start, how I'm going to start. It was a great opportunity to see some of the best entrepreneurs in the world pitching Sequoia. And so ultimately, that's how I ended up there and eventually building the business from there.
In terms of like how you think about your own relationship to risk, was it difficult taking the plunge into Nubank, which at the time was a new startup and full of risk?
Yeah, it was very easy. I didn't think it twice. I knew very clearly that I wanted to start a business at some point. By then, it got to a point after 2 years for Sequoia where we all kind of came to a sad conclusion that we didn't want to really start a business in Brazil, which meant Doug wanted me to go back to California and helping them invest globally, look at some Asian investments. And I just wasn't passionate about investing anymore. I just wasn't. When I sat with the entrepreneur and I heard entrepreneur talking about his or her business, it was very clear to me that I wanted to be on that side of the table and that it was just too easy for me to give the entrepreneur advice and tell the entrepreneur, go faster or grow better or hire better. And I just didn't feel qualified to be giving advice. I didn't have the operating experience. I had never built a company before. I hadn't really had an operating role. I was more of an investor. So it was a combination of just feeling disqualified for the job, regardless if I had a Sequoia Capital business card or not. But also I was very clear that what I really wanted to do was take the risk and go for it and build a business and almost have that adventure and see what happened.
Kenneth, you mentioned Doug, you mentioned Mike. The Sequoia partnership is a very special one. In terms of, and this was actually Doug's question, in terms of your experience at Sequoia, how do you think it impacted your operating mentality founding and operating Nubank?
It was very influential. Sequoia is a very unique place and it's unique because of its culture. It's rare to see a venture firm that has been successful for so long through different generations. And it really comes down to their culture. And before at Sequoia, I came from cultures that were much more traditional, financial services culture, investment banking, private equity. And it was a shock the first week I was at Sequoia. Everything was different. First, it was a true partnership where there's very little hierarchy. As an intern from business school, I was asked in the first meeting, in the first investment committee, what I thought about an investment. I was completely unprepared for that. I was used to sitting over there on the back of the investment committee, keeping my mouth shut, hearing all the bosses make all the decisions. And here I was sitting next to Doug in the investment committee, looking at deals for Sequoia, asking people for my opinion and being treated since the first second as a real partner, as we're all in the same boat. There's no bosses and that comes with responsibilities as well as benefits. And so that flatness and lack of hierarchy and partnership was a shock for me, but it was very motivating. I remember a couple of months after being at Sequoia, I had never felt so motivated in my entire life working in a job because I felt like a true partner. I felt like I was really impactful. Doug gave me a ton of autonomy since day one. He said, here you go. You have Latin America. Find investments. Let me know what you find. And so it was this huge challenge, this entire geography. And I was flying to Sao Paulo from San Francisco Tuesday afternoon, having 8 meetings with entrepreneur on a Wednesday and flying back on Thursday in time for my business school class. There was no questions asked. And literally, Doug would just sit down in my office and said, what do you think about this? And what do you think about this? So it was, there was a lot of elements of the Sequoia culture that were very, very motivating, that I could see how they contributed to a culture of performance, because true performance stayed, and then very quickly people that were not performing were out, but it was a fair, it was a transparent culture. And so when I decided to start Nubank, one of the first things to do is obviously I did the pitch deck of Nubank to raise capital, but the second thing I did was the culture deck of Nubank. And it was a deck that in a way personified the values that Nubank was going to have as a company. When I go back and I look at the deck, a lot of the values that we had then and we have now as a company, such as flat and meritocracy and motivation and sort of that ownership mentality, very much resembled some of the things that I saw at Sequoia, obviously now at a very large organization. Some of the things that Sequoia had are non-scalable. You can do that when you have 30 people. You cannot do it when you have 3,000. But it was very, very much influential, and I was very lucky to have been able to see that.
I do want to ask, you mentioned that the scale of the organization today, and one thing that's just very obvious is the incredible growth that you've seen with Nubank. And so, one thing that I do just want to touch on first, and it's kind of high level, but it's like when you see the rapid scaling that you've seen, what's the first elements to break?
There's the obvious parts of that answer, which is tech will break, there will be crashes, there will be fires, there'll be firefighting, there'll be mistakes done with customers where for a company and culture is so focused on customer experience, every mistake done to a customer customer, it feels like a punch in the stomach. So you feel it very deeply. So all of that stuff will happen inevitably with scale and with fast growth. And it is what it is. But some of the areas that I've come to appreciate more that are tend to be even more complex is the relationship between growth and quality. You want to grow. There is no sense. Like growth is life. As a startup, you have to grow. But if you comes at the expense of a lot of quality, then you're losing what is giving you that growth. Now, the other extreme is you need to maintain perfect quality and there is no tolerance for failure. There is no tolerance for crashes, which is also death. You cannot go into that extreme. So what's really hard is finding that balance where you're maintaining a very large growth rate while maintaining great quality. And beyond that is realizing that a lot of the times quality gives you growth and growth actually gives you quality. They're not necessarily a trade-off. It's not necessarily a zero-sum game. A lot of the times you face this dilemma and I need to sacrifice one for the sake of the other one. In reality, sometimes you have to do those trades in the short term. But if you architect the company the right way, the technology, the culture, both, you can attain both in the long term. By more quality will give you growth in the long term. Higher growth will allow you to invest in more quality and better systems and better people. So they actually end up reinforcing with each other.
I love that in terms of kind of the flywheel between quality and growth there. If you think about kind of growth in one dimension, you can grow product lines and you can grow geographically. You know, when we look at, you know, Nubank, you've obviously decided to grow, I mean, in both, but let's start on geographically. First, just from like a landscape perspective, many have tried to grow across LATAM and haven't worked. Just help me understand, why haven't they worked? And what are you doing differently to make it work for Nubank?
So I think the reality is that Latin America is a collection of very different countries, each country with its own specificities of regulation and culture and local. And so you cannot treat it as a big country. You can treat it as a multiple countries. That increases the complexity of internationalization. And my view of why it has failed in certain areas is actually that I think companies have tried to do it too early in their life cycle. And you have to do it once you have a very strong core, when you actually have won the first country. So for us, there was always a debate. I guess first, the decision about internationalization is not an obvious one, especially when you're in a country like Brazil. If you are starting a smaller country, you have to go to internationalize. There is no option. But when you start in a big country, internationalization is as obvious. You always have the trade-offs of building more in a big market versus going to a second market. So the way to think about this for us was, if you have a five-year horizon, it doesn't make no sense. We shouldn't internationalize. Brazil has a lot. But if you have a 20-year horizon, then yes, it starts making more sense. You are expanding your market. You're expanding your addressable market. You have the opportunity to leverage a lot of the technology and culture and people that you build for one country and other ones. The strategic logic for that starts making more sense. And then it's a question about when is the right time. And that is really the hardest question. I think for us was, we had a conversation in our board in 2000, after 3 years in, where I suggested going to Mexico, and the board slapped me in the face and said, no way. You're still trying to figure out Brazil. You're still trying to figure out your business. You have product market fit. Double down on the product market fit, but it's too premature. And they were totally right. But by the time we had that conversation again in 2019, we were profitable in Brazil. We were cash flow positive. We have great product market fit. We have banking licenses. We were fully funded on deposits. So we had to risk the business massively, which meant we will be able to take this next step by risking a small percentage of the core, which continues to be the most important part of our strategy.
I mean, I love that in terms of the changes that happened. Incredible to hear about how strong the core was. Can I ask, in that you've been on the other side of the table, obviously, as a VC and giving advice, for you as an entrepreneur, how do you think about, when you kind of think back to that board advice, how do you think about the advice to ingest and take on board and, you know, act on versus the advice, quite rightly, which may not be right, that you discard and you go your own way? How do you determine whether to accept or reject advice?
I think you always have to, especially with your board members, which hopefully are people that you have significant influence in picking. Generally, they end up being your investors, which meant hopefully you had the luxury to pick your investors and you had the luxury to be strategic about how to build your cap table, which in our way should be as carefully done as building your management team. Each person in that table has to have a role and a different experience so that they can really add value. So if that exists, then you have to have a view of really listening to people's opinion, because that's precisely what you brought them. But then you really have to hear around the why. and really the argument that people are using. And sometimes they'll just give you their opinion and their hunch. And their opinion is not necessarily going to be worth more than your opinion. If we're talking opinions, then you can very quickly discard it. And some of the best board members will tell you specifically that this is just my uninformed opinion, so take it or leave it. A lot of great board members does a great job doing that when he gives his point of view based on his experience, by no means has domain expertise in certain areas, and he will tell you that. But sometimes they will actually come and talk out of true experience, and you really have to listen, and sometimes you realize you're right and you're wrong, and alignments, and you know, and everybody's incentives are fully aligned. We want the company to succeed, and so if there is no ego, if there's no attachment to an idea, then you will agree to do their best thing for the company, and you will be very, very open to hear those point of views.
We mentioned kind of geographic expansion. The other form of expansion is obviously also kind of product and services expansion. You know, all fintechs kind of aspire and start with kind of one point product, which is kind of hopefully, you know, low customer acquisition costs, and then they cross sell other products. We both know it normally fails kind of 99% of the time. How did you make it work in terms of that successful insertion and then successful cross sell?
You know, I tend to think similarly as internationalization, that if you don't do it too prematurely, if you don't try to go to product number two too quickly, you will succeed in cross-selling. Like, it shouldn't be that hard. If you crack the code with your first product, if you build a phenomenal brand that people love with that first product, if the experience works, if you build trust, if you have high NPS, if it's stable, if you're really solving a problem, people will be very much willing to get your product number two and product number three and product number four. Sometimes the mistake that has happened in some of those of going to from one to two to three is because companies try to do it too early, and then they haven't really built that core enough. And I guess for us, we did credit card for 4 years. That's all we did. I remember all the conversation we had inside the company, all the external pressure where we saw competitors launching product two and product three and product four, and all this anxiety. Are we falling behind? Do we need to launch them? And we just stick to doing one thing very well for 4 years, and we're doing what we said. We own our own destiny, getting to the absolutely highest NPS in the world on the first product, growing word of mouth, maintaining the experience, maintaining the quality. By the time year number five, we launched product number two, there was so much excitement from our customer base, and they trusted us on Match that they were very much willing to accept it. And product number two for us, which is savings, is way bigger than product number one for us. And product number three is growing faster than product number two. So each iteration, it actually, there is another flywheel, which is if people like product number one, they should love all the other ones. Hopefully, if you did a good job designing and building it. So it really is about when you launch product two and not if you launch it, I think.
Do you see much increased velocity in terms of from product two to product three versus product one to two? Because you're obviously leveraging the brand, the NPS, the customer base. Does it become faster and faster, whereby four and five is even quicker than two and three, and then five and six is so much more compressed than that? Do you think you see this even more compression in terms of that release cadence?
Yeah, absolutely. I think once you go from one to two, then two to three to four, you end up architecting your systems in a platform way in which the cost to launch the following product becomes easier and simpler. Initially, when you architect your products, you're building, for us, we were building a credit card company. We were not building a multi-product bank. And so we had to really redirect all our infrastructure, organizational structure to go multi-product, multi-geo, which was a lot of significant work. So you absolutely see that.
Can I ask, on the core first product, you know, I think a lot of, you know, neobanks in London have really struggled in terms of unit econ, especially around customer acquisition costs, where they're sky high and then the LTVs aren't really fully baked out. I've seen before, you know, you speak about, you know, your CACs, same for that in certain cases at $0. Can you walk me through how you think about like customer acquisition costs and your lessons maybe on kind of CAC optimization?
Yeah, I mean, I think that CAC will be a function of the product that you build and the market you're serving. The example that you're giving in other neobanks in our economies, I think partly it's a harder market to crack because frankly, the customer pain is not that acute. Banking works fairly well in the US and Europe. Margins are tight. Incumbents have done a decent job digitalizing, which means there's definitely opportunity and some people have been very successful, but the customer pain is not that large. When you go to Brazil and you see customers paying 450% APRs and paying a ton of different fees and waiting 4 months to open a bank account, or you go to Mexico and you see five banks owning 90% of all the assets of the system, the pain is 10x where you might see in the US. And so if you approach that pain with a product that is 100x better, that ultimately translates into very, very, very low, close to zero customer acquisition cost. And I think for us, also philosophically, we always, since the beginning, said we'll focus on building the absolutely best product that we can have, the best experience, and trying to, instead of investing money on marketing and giving that money to Google and Facebook, we'll leave those money in the pockets of our customers in a way in which we don't charge any fees. And we pay great salaries in customer service to make sure that we're giving great customer service, and we'll invest in the experience versus investing in the market. And ultimately, that creates this word of mouth viral effect that has what's driven our growth since we effectively launched.
Can I ask, when you're 100x better, as you said, the word of mouth and the flywheel just starts. And when you see the users pour in, it's amazing and it's fantastic, but also the capital intensity to serve them, I imagine, is just pretty high. How have you thought about kind of capital intensity in terms of serving user bases? And what are your thoughts or lessons around kind of capital intensity and kind of funding requirements?
Yeah, no, sure. I mean, I think when we started launching, I remember seeing the avalanche of customers, and we didn't have the capital to serve all the customers that actually wanted our product, which is always interesting to see how some of these constraints really create creativity. And so what we had to do at that point, since we didn't have the capital, to your point, we had to create a waiting list. But we created that waiting list, and it became almost an exclusive and desirable asset to have our card. And the fact that it was exclusive, plus a lot of smart social media marketing and influencers, created even more demand for the product, which created more scarcity in the product. And so that constrained demand allowed us to go and raise capital to investors, obviously to solve the capital need, which then allowed us to go and release more customers and continue growing that way. So now in financial services, especially in lending, capital, but more especially liquidity, is one of the biggest bottlenecks that you have. So one of the things we did very early on is, yeah, we are a technology company. We have technology company DNA, but we need a lot of expertise in more of the traditional banking areas like liquidity management and capital management. We have several banking licenses now and regulated entities. You need really, really strong controls, what we call here defense, around do we have the capital, the liquidity to withstand very, very significant shocks and very significant adverse circumstances. But anyway, you can manage that with the right team, the right skills in the company, but you can also use it in your favor by building certain virality hooks in the product.
You mentioned there in terms of the, you know, capital inflows into the market itself, you know, it seems everyone is starting a neobank today. How do you feel about that? And how do you foresee kind of the I know it's a horribly kind of generic question, so forgive me for it, but like the neobanking landscape evolve, will we see the verticalization of it? Will we see the complete horizontal neobanks? How do you think about the evolution of the neobanking space with the proliferation of capital and companies?
Yeah, so it's incredible for me to see this environment today, because I remember running around in 2013, talking to people in Brazil and even in the US about building a new bank. And there was so much skepticism. And especially in Brazil, where you have five banks that own 86% of the entire system, and they are seen as the most invulnerable, most powerful corporations in Latin America. These brands are seen as you cannot really challenge them. There was a lot of fear in the market about going and attempt to challenge any of these brands. The overwhelming consensus was the barriers of entry are so high, it's impossible for an entrepreneur to build a bank from scratch. And 8 years after, it's a commodity. It's crazy. It's everybody's building their bank. The ride-sharing apps are building their banks. The retailers are building their banks. The offline retailers are building. Everybody's building a bank. So it actually reminds me a lot of one of the trends that we were seeing in Brazil in 2011 with Groupon. At some point, when some of the first business model we saw in Brazil, where there were 3,000 Groupon clones in Brazil. People were starting a Groupon clone in different neighborhoods in Sao Paulo. And obviously, none of that is sustainable. The fact that barriers to entry are low means they're low for everybody. And ultimately, if you're not charging any fees, you really need significant scale and operational efficiency to be able to have a very profitable business in the long term. So my view is that we're in the era of exuberance, a lot of capital are flowing in, but customers will have less apps in their phone, not more, and they will not have five banking relationships or 10 banking relationships or five different wallets. So I would expect a significant consolidations of that over the next few years. And I would expect a lot of mix between banks living in e-commerce ecosystems, e-commerce living in the bank's ecosystems where you're calling embedded finance. So a lot of mix around ecosystems of consumers, you being able to use your financial services products in a number of different areas, but not being constrained necessarily by the one relationship that you might have in e-commerce or in financial services, or let's say ride-hailing, for example.
You mentioned operational efficiency and scale there. I do want to slightly apply that to you if it's okay and not too self-reflective, but it's like, you know, with the scale of the organization, you also have to scale as a leader, and, you know, it's probably one of the hardest things. How have you seen your leadership style change with the growth of Nubank?
It's been the hardest thing, I think, for me. Scaling myself, is evolving myself. The analogy sometimes I use is, I found odd that the founder and CEO titles are generally so linked to each other. Because if the founder is a horse and the CEO is a rhino, I think the good founder and CEO is the unicorn. Is this horse that has been able to grow a horn and is this mythical creature. And I find it hard and mythical because they're very different roles. They're almost completely opposite. And sometimes what makes you great at one doesn't necessarily make you good at the other one. In fact, some of the things that a great founder does, sometimes some of the attributes of a great founder, you have to tone them down a little bit as a great CEO. And so finding that balance and being able to go from founder to CEO, it's been quite a journey. By no means, I'm even close, I think, to having cracked the code, but it's a challenge. It's a significant challenge.
You left me a cliffhanger there. What do you think you have to tone down that great founders have, but maybe isn't inherent within great CEOs?
So when you are a founder, I think you have to have very strong convictions. You're taking a bet, right? As a founder, you are going all in. You are completely concentrated, risking everything you got on one bet for a number of different years. That takes a significant amount of conviction. And you have to be willing to ignore a lot of voices and go against a lot of people. CEOs, I don't think, can do that. They cannot afford to do that. They need to evolve in a way in which they are able to listen to a number of different voices. They have to be really, really great listeners. They have to be great managers, which founders rarely are. Founders like to get their hands dirty and build the product with their own hands. You cannot scale that. As a CEO of a large company, you need to have people that are building a lot of the products. You can get involved in different areas. You can pick your spot. You can give your opinion. But you're not building the product yourself. You're not building with your own hands. You have large teams of people that are building the product, large teams of people that are talking to customers. Christina and me, my co-founder, we used to get customers' calls in my phone. I love that. I still reply every single customer email that gets into my inbox. But it gets to a point where I cannot do that anymore. And sometimes I actually need to be checking with legal and with PR about the type of responses I don't get in harm. So unfortunately, as a great CEO, I think the company can't afford for you to bet everything you got on one, put all your chips on one table. You have to manage, although you have to also lead. And you just have to be spending a lot of your time doing things that might not necessarily be talk to your strengths, but the CEO role requires you to do it.
Can I ask, you mentioned that a lot of that was kind of around the theme of delegation. I think a lot of founders really struggle to delegate, especially it's your baby. It's the thing that is, the most dear to you. What advice would you give? And I really struggle with this on media companies. So you're advising me and you can invoice me later for the advice. But what advice would you give to founders, which is how do I delegate effectively and efficiently? And how do I let go of the reins?
Well, it begins with great people. So it's a given. You have to have phenomenal talent that you can delegate for. You have to trust the person. Partly of the hesitancy to delegate comes from hesitance around, do I have the right person in the role? So if you haven't figured it out yet, then you have to really think about the question, is this person the right person for the role? Now, if you have confidence that this is the person for the right role, then you have to trust. Then that's precisely why you went to very great lengths to hire the very best people. You cannot just go through all those legs and then bring them in and then micromanage that person. Then once that happens, you have to just give a lot of autonomy, let the person fail, be there close to that person and coach them and allow for some mistakes, but just step back and let this person that you hire do the role. And then consistently provide support, but also be thinking, is this the right person for the role? Which in a fast-growing organization, the answer might be yes today. 6 months from now, it might be no. The organization changes so much, the complexity grows so quickly, that this is a question that you have to consistently be asking yourself.
The main man, Doug Leone, asked a tough question. And he said, with regards to leadership, and with the growth of yourself as a leader, everyone always has self-doubt. He asked, did you ever have imposter syndrome? And how did you deal with that?
Definitely. I think I have more imposter syndrome about CEO than about founder. Precisely. Sometimes I think because there is an expectation that the CEO has all the answers. And for somebody that didn't do a lot of financial services before, or that didn't start a lot of companies before, there is no way I have all the answers. So that ultimately means that if you have that expectation the CEO has all the answers, then you're being an imposter by playing the role. That's what's hard, but ultimately the CEO has other functions, and a lot of the other functions the CEO has is leading an organization, is recruiting great talent, is building a great team. And so if you change your expectation and realize you don't need to have all the answers, but you have to be willing to bring great talent that has all those answers, then that's okay. Then it's fine. And then your role is more less than answering all the questions, is finding the great people and putting the mission that will attract the people that will answer all those questions.
Can I ask, when I have a problem that I'm just like, I don't know what to do, and it's horizontal, it could be across anything from legal to financing to you name your problem, there's like, you know, one person who I go to no matter what the problem is for the advice, for the reassurance. Do you have like a go-to person who's the sounding board, who is your safe space?
Not fully, not like that, not one single. I try to have a large network of people that are experts in different things that I can, either internally or externally, that I can go to for advice on a number of different topics. But I wouldn't say I have one single person that can serve as that.
Well, I am now always here for you, David. So
thank you.
There we go. It's been a productive conversation. I do want to move into my favorite though, David, which is a quick fire round. So I say a short statement and then you give me your immediate thoughts. How does that sound?
Okay, great. Let's do it.
Okay, so what's the favorite book and why?
100 Years of Solitude by Gabriel Garcia Marquez. I don't love business books. I love fiction. And it's a great story. And it's very representative of Colombia, where I'm from. So I love it.
Okay. Secret to convincing the best talent to move to LATAM.
It's hard. And there are big challenges. And US and Europe is too easy. You're going to work very, very, very hard to make the life of the 1%, 5% better. If you move to Latin America, you're going to work very, very hard to make the life of 99% of the people 70% better. So ultimately, just way much more impact.
How did you respond to your greatest failure?
There is a framework that we talked here a lot about. It's called the responsibility process, where the first instinct is always denial or blame, but very quickly you go move the faces and you end up in responsibility. When I failed, I feel those faces and my instinct naturally is denial or blame. I try to get myself very quickly to responsibility, to how did I fail? Taking responsibility for what happened and making sure that I'm learning from that failure.
Help me out here. That's too good. So you have denial and you have blame. What's in between denial and blame and responsibility? Are there steps in between those two?
Yeah, I don't think I'm going to be able to say all of that, but it's denial, then blame, then I think there's a point where you also want to quit, then obligation. You feel that you're going to do it, but you feel obliged, and then finally responsibility. I think I'm skipping one or two, but look it up. It's called the responsibility process.
I'm going to look it up. That's going to be a lot of future questions answered with that one. And this is really tough. What three traits would you most want your children to adopt?
I don't know what the best way to say it, but I'll go back to Doug Leone's wise words, which is a bit of a sense of desperation, like a hunger. I want them, it's the opposite of entitlement. I want them to want something really badly, whatever it might be, and feel that they got to work hard to get that. So that desperation, I think, is a very valuable thing. It's a very great motivator. That's number one. Number two, curiosity. I want my kids to be exposed to everything so that they ask a lot of questions. I think a worthwhile life is a life that it's filled with knowledge and lessons and curiosity and creativity. And so I want them to show that curiosity all around. And third, I think it's being good people, is being having a good heart and having empathy, seeing that they have a role to play in society and that is important, especially when you are in a region of the world like ours, where there is so much poverty and so many social problems, that they feel that they have almost an obligation, a responsibility to contribute to a bigger purpose in society, to leave the place where they grew up a little bit better.
Which leader do you most look up to and why?
I've been rereading this biography, which is great. I don't know if you're familiar with Chuck Finney. Chuck Finney was there's a great book about him called The Billionaire Who Wasn't. He was the founder of Duty Free Shoppers, the duty free shop that you see all around the world in airports. He sold the company to LVMH for, I think, $4 billion. And he committed to spend all that money before he died, spending it while living it. And it's an unbelievable read. It's one of the most inspiring stories I've ever read about how much he has done and how much he did it anonymously. People just don't know. He's been partly responsible for the peace process in Ireland. He's partly responsible for changing the entire education system in Vietnam. He's incredibly responsible for changing the education system in the US. So it's amazing what one person can do and have done it so on the low end. So it's a great read. I recommend it.
And then listen, I love that. And I'm actually going to add it to my list. I'm in need of a new book. So that's an awesome one. Tell me, and this is always a tough one, but it's just me and you, David. No one's listening, so it's totally fine. Who's the most memorable board member and why?
Probably all my board members are listening to this.
No, no one listens to this, David. It's fine.
No, listen, I really can't tell. Doug has been phenomenal. Nigel has been a mentor since the very beginning, and I looked up to him a lot and learning the Capital One story. Nicolas from Cas Adventures, back to our seat, has been with us since the very beginning, has been a great mentor. Mickey Malka, they've all have been great in different ways. I cannot pick favorites, sorry.
David, do not worry. I think you also have a career as a politician post Newbank, so there we go. I do want to finish though on probably the most exciting of all, which is like, I was going to say next 5 years, but I don't want to constrain it to 5 years, actually. Like, when you look forward 10, 15, 20 years, whatever that time frame is, how big can Newbank be? And paint that picture for me of just what it can be.
I honestly think there is no limit. It can be one of the largest companies in the world. I'm very confident with that. It really is up to we talk about it as a team. It really is up to us to decide how big we want it to grow, because financial services is one of the largest segments in the world, and emerging markets is one of the most interesting places to be doing financial services in the world. And once you have one of the largest financial services companies in the world, then there's really no limit inside in terms of what other products or services you can go. And I think ultimately we see ourselves as a consumer-focused company, as a company that wants to solve problems for consumers. And we happen to begin in financial services, but consumers have problems in N different sectors. So really the question for us is, why do we prioritize? What is more important next? Where can we win? Where do we put our chips? But we are a company that has a very long-term orientation. We really are building this company for several decades. We have phenomenal, phenomenal people, some of the best talent in the world. And so I cannot really imagine what the end it is. It's never ending.
Well, I mean, I'm only sad that I'm not an investor. It's like tantalizing, but I do want to say...
It's still early. It's early days.
There we go. I mean, next round is upon us. So please listen, I so enjoyed this. I heard so many great things. So thank you so much for joining me. And this was so much fun.
Thank you, Harry. It was a pleasure to be with you. Appreciate the questions.
Absolutely fantastic to have David on the show there, and such exciting times ahead for him and for Newbank. If you'd like to see more from us behind the scenes, you can, of course, on Instagram at hstebbings1996 with two Bs. I always love to see you there. But before we leave you today, did you know that more than 80% of US public stock is owned by just 10% of Americans? This divide is even greater in the private markets. Carta makes it as easy to issue equity to your employees as it is to issue payroll, and for employees, as easy to accept it too. More than 16,000 companies issue equity to their employees through Carta. Whether you're just getting started or getting ready to go public, the team at Carta can help. Check them out at carta.com. And then another incredible product you have to introduce is SecureFrame. SecureFrame helps companies get enterprise ready by streamlining SOC 2 and ISO 27001 compliance. SecureFrame allows companies to get compliant within weeks rather than the painful months that is today. Join companies like Stream, Hasura, Benepass, and unlock more sales with SecureFrame. And 20 VC listeners get 10% off at secureframe.com/20VC. And finally, I've always been a big history fan, and so I want to talk about Cooley, the global law firm built around startups and venture capital. Since forming the very first venture fund in Silicon Valley, Cooley's formed more venture capital funds than any other law firm in the world, with 50 plus years working with VCs. They help VCs form and manage funds, make investments, and handle the myriad of issues that arise throughout a fund's lifetime. So to learn more about the number one most active law firm representing VC backed companies going public, head over to Cooley.com and also check out CooleyGo.com.
As always, I so appreciate all your support, and I can't wait to bring you an incredible episode this coming Monday with Peter Fenton at Benchmark.